Janine Price, who played the violin, is a member of this church. I would like to add a word to Woody Haugill's about the name tags. The name tags, which are in the window ledge over in that corner in the foyer, are for people who have fairly recently joined the church. And I noticed this morning that there were name tags there for the Selbys and the Gilbronsons and the Brocks and some others who are here. You do not have to take those home. They can be left. In fact, most people find that it's very handy to leave them here and then pick them up when they come in the morning. We also have some temporary paper tags and pins out in the foyer that we would like for any of you who plan to attend the Continental Breakfast this morning to use. We're doing that so that we can know each other better. I thought it might be a good time this morning, while we are happy about the new members of this church, to take a look at ourselves and what it is exactly these promising people have come into. Let's start by pretending that the Apostle Paul has flown into Mid-Continent Airport and asked to be directed to the meeting place of the people in Wichita who are Christians. Paul says it with an odd inflection, as if it were an unusual word for something quite important. The counter clerk takes a quick look at the little man with the full black beard and the puzzled look and thinks, "Oh boy, I've got one." But what he says is, "Which church did you have in mind, sir?" Something about Paul's face makes him say "sir" at the last minute. Paul stares at him. "Which one? How many are there?" "Oh, more than 100, probably. Which one do you want?" "I don't know, any one of them, I guess." At which point people in the line start to shuffle and cough, and the clerk shoves a thick book across the desk at the old saint. "Here's a directory of the churches. Pick one, and I'll tell you how to get there as soon as I have a minute." So Paul looks through the book, and being a graduate of the school of Gamaliel and a fine scholar, he sees an intriguing name: University Congregational Church. You could never have guessed. And he puts a check by that one with the eagle feather pin he has brought all the way from Jerusalem through the time warp. The clerk starts to tell him how to get to East 29th, takes a second look at Paul's beard and his quaint tunic, and says, "See the yellow thing outside the sliding door? That's a cab. Give him this address, and he'll get you there in time for their 10 o'clock worship." They do make it, but Paul turns out to have the wrong money. So one of our ushers, Betty Johnson, opens her purse and pays the fare while Paul tries to handle the humiliation of being rescued by a woman, one who directs him to a pew as if she'd never heard any of his remarks about women and how they should take a subordinate role in the church. Let's leave him in the most comfortable seat he's ever used and imagine that we have sent our moderator, John Carraway, by way of a time machine to first century Corinth to take a look at their church. He sees a big temple not far from the port that looks as if it might be a church, and he starts in that direction with a long, loping stride that has everybody on the streets of Corinth turning around to watch one of the tallest men they have ever seen. He notices Just outside the porch of the temple, a group of attractive young women. And he says to a passerby, "My, you certainly have an active youth group in your church," only to have the stranger say, "That's not a church, friend. That's the temple of Aphrodite, goddess of love, and those are some of her 1,000 priestess prostitutes who keep the temple a busy and profitable place, especially when the ships are in." Well, John is pretty much unflappable, so he blushes only slightly at his mistake. And he says, "Could you tell me where the people meet who call themselves Christians?" And the man says, "I think I know that group. Take this road about a half a mile to an old white house with the sign of the fish on the front door." John finds it, goes in, and can't believe what he sees and hears. There are people in a state of high excitement, all seeming to talk at once, some even babbling in a different language from the rest, singing when they feel like singing, with no Francis Sloan to guide them, no section leaders, no priests at the piano, no piano, in fact, and apparently with no one person who appears to be responsible for what's going on. Chaotic. Now, John is a man of considerable dignity. He looks at all that chaos and hears all that noise, and he says, "This is the church?" Back in Wichita, Paul is equally dumbfounded by how quiet it is and how orderly. In fact, he wonders if he has stumbled by mistake into a funeral. And then another woman surprises him when she stands up with no veil over her head and makes some announcements. This man who wrote, "Let women keep silence in the assembly." And so he mumbles to himself, "Oh my, this is the church?" And he wonders whom to blame for what's happening until he notices that one person has on a garment different from everybody else's and seems to pop up and down a lot and talk too much, but at least, praise the old Hebrew scripture, is a male. It surprises him when the man mentions his name, Paul's name, in the speech, and it surprises him even more how the man interprets some of the things Paul remembers having said, but he rather likes the attention. He can't get over how rich and prosperous everybody looks, and he thinks how nice it would have been if he could have appealed to them when he took up his collection for the poor in Jerusalem. But he supposes that they have their own poor somewhere to whom they are generous. I wish I could go on and imagine a personal encounter between the Apostle Paul and John Caraway and a chance to say to them, "Guess what you two have in common?" But I know the answer to that, and the answer is what this sermon is really about. Before I name it, let's think for a moment about how much the church has changed just in the lifetime of some of us. When some of us were kids, the culture around us helped to prop up the church. What I mean is that nothing much was happening on Sunday, all day and all evening, so that going to church was not so bad. In fact, it was about as good a place to meet girls or boys as you could find, and our folks didn't have much social life outside the church, so they liked it. Even if you lived in a wet county, you couldn't buy anything to drink on Sunday. Even the picture show closed down. You couldn't see a movie Sunday afternoon or Sunday night. Everything was helping to prop up the church. But that changed. And one minister I know remembers when he saw it change, even though he didn't understand it at the time. It was in 1963 in Greenville, South Carolina, when the Fox Theater, in defiance of the state's old blue laws, opened on a Sunday. This minister, who was then a boy, and six of his buddies, all regular in attendance at the Methodist Youth Fellowship in the Buncombe Street Church, agreed to go in the front door of the church to be seen by everybody, and then quietly slip out the back door and join John Wayne at the Fox. That night, he says, the town of Greenville served notice that it would no longer be a prop for the church. If Christians were going to be made in Greenville, the church would have to do it by itself. The Fox would go head to head with the church to see who would provide the ultimate values for the young. And that night, the Fox won. It was like that when I was a child. The church, the home, and the state formed a vast consortium working together to instill Christian values. People grew up Christian simply by growing up American, at least in my part of the country, where we hardly knew there were Jewish Americans with a rich and wonderful heritage of their own. Well, the culture no longer props up the church, and it may be a blessing. The church has always been at its best in tough times, not in good ones. Jerry Falwell may still think that if we elect a few senators, pass some new laws, restore Father Knows Best to TV, we can relax and let the culture do our work for us, but most of us know better. Jewish people, by the way, have understood this in America. They've been a minority, so in this country, they haven't been able to make the state a full ally in propping up their faith. And as a result, they've had to take care of that themselves. They tell their children, you're different. You're special. We have a different story. You're going to hear it often, so you won't forget it. There are certain things we will do as a family around a table that will make you know your identity. Christians will have to do that too, now that the state isn't helping them so much. Say to their children, it's a very special thing to be a Christian. We want some other things out of life than what our neighbors want. We have some different opinions about things. We are members of a Christian church. It has a bearing on what we do at school, on a date, in business. It means something. Isn't that an odd thing to say, that the church has to learn the peculiarity of being Christian? We aren't born that way. The church has to make us Christian. The church has to form intentionally a peculiar people. Mainline churches in recent years have subscribed to the prevailing view that what we need to do is help people express their wants and desires and their rights. But the gospel is really very different from that. It says that by rooting around in our own egos, or by reflecting on our life experiences as men or women, whites or blacks, we won't really discover much worth knowing unless we view it through the mind of this Jew from Nazareth, who is the way, the truth, and the life. What the church has to do, what this church that you are now a part of has to do, is form people who can be in the world without being seduced by its wisdom. People who know what it means to say, Jesus is Lord, or if that embarrasses you, and you'd like to hear it another way, that there are lifestyles and values that go with his being Lord, and that they have to be taken seriously. So we're not just an educating outfit. We are a forming force. We have to shape people by words and stories and rituals to live in a world that does not take that seriously. And does not take seriously the one we say had the truth about how to live. Now, you know me too well to think that I'm talking about raising our hands and shouting and crying in public about how emotional it makes us feel to hear the name of Jesus shouted by an evangelist. I'm talking about people so secure that they can crack a joke one minute and go far beyond decency and normal kindness the next minute because they have to. Because they are part of a community that says, there was this man who taught us strange things about how to live, and they've turned out to be true for people who really tried them. And since we've chosen to wear his name, we have to try them too. Being a Christian is more like learning to paint or dance than it is like having a personal experience or finding out something about yourself. It takes time and effort and will. When you ask people how they were shaped to be what they are, you find out that the process was often mundane, unspectacular. There was an admired Sunday school teacher who actually spent a few hours in the week getting ready to say some good things to you. There was the habit of being brought to church by your parents, a habit that was not optional, so that you learned there were some things you just did until you got old enough to make your own choices. There was a minister who was helpful in some difficult time in your life and who occasionally in his sermons said something worth remembering. There was the friendship when you sodded the grass, planted the trees, painted the classrooms, and the way you comforted each other when a husband was lost or a mother, and the smiles you shared at the christenings and the weddings. It's never an accident, this being formed into somebody a little different. The church has to care about all the things that make people feel part of a special community. The daily, quiet acts of compassion and friendship, the hospital visit, the covered dish supper, the birthday card, the hour spent preparing food for the family that has lost someone, the special hour on Sunday mornings like this one, in the light-filled room with the music and the prayer and the moments of reflection prompted by somebody's words. We have made a thrilling and beautiful beginning. This morning, we've welcomed another impressive group of talented people who promise by their presence that they will help us make the years to come even better. for them and for us. May it be so.